The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century of Lies, it's morning again in America, so it's time to wake up, smell the coffee, and take a good hard look at stimulants. Cameron Niaz is an epidemiologist in the drug research section of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime.
So if you look at the stimulants, they are a diverse group of substances, as we all understand. And among the stimulants, we see amphetamines as yet another group of substances as the most common group of stimulants that are used, with the prevalence of around 0.7% of the global population, around 34 million people. And then you see a bit of lesser prevalence and number of people using cocaine and ecstasy. And as Anya had said, if you put, notwithstanding the polydrug use, if you put together all these numbers, they almost come to be more than or maybe comparable to the number of people using opioids globally. If you look at the prevalence of stimulants in the various regions, you also see that the Americas kind of like stand out both for the use of amphetamine and cocaine as compared to the other regions. When you look at the what is the most common stimulant that is used across the world, we see that each region and literally each country is characterized by a different type of stimulant use. And here we see that North and South America and Australia as one are like characterized by the use of cocaine as the main substance. Whereas if you go to the rest of the world, you look at Russia and Europe, Asia, different parts of Asia, you see the predominance of amphetamines in those regions. Again, having said that, we all know that polydrug use is a common phenomenon among all drug users. Most drug users, use of stimulants, again, as we all know, is like commonly seen both in recreational settings, but also among high-risk drug users or marginalized populations across the world. Just as a very short-term trend, during the COVID-19 periods, we saw a bit of a declining trend in the use of most of the stimulants across all regions. But since then, we see that the levels of use have rebounded for most of the stimulants, except for the use of ecstasy. When we look at the use of amphetamines, and again, notwithstanding the polydrug use, which is a common phenomenon among stimulant users, as with most other drugs, we see a particular amphetamine as the predominant substance use in each of the country or the region. And again, starting from the left, we see in the U.S. and most parts of South America, the non-medical use of pharmaceutical stimulants as the predominant amphetamine use. If we go to Europe, to Russia, to most parts of Africa, especially North Africa, we see the use of amphetamine as the main substance within this group. And then Asia, Southeast Asia, and Australia are characterized as predominantly the countries or the regions where you see a higher level of or predominance of methamphetamine in those regions. Again, if you look at the treatment provision, the most common drug and treatment also in terms of the stimulants kind of like reflect the same pattern that we had observed in the use of those different substances. And there, that's what you see in this map. So if you look at the gender distribution or the gender differences in the use of different drugs, we see that women in general are less likely than men to use drugs. But for some drugs, especially for opioids and cocaine, we see that women are, like, for instance, 3 times less likely to use drugs. But when we look at the non-medical use of stimulants, when we look at the use of amphetamines, for instance, we see that the gender gap is quite narrowed, and almost similar proportions of men and women use stimulants other than cocaine. Again, one, I think, important part with regard to that, despite that there is a narrow gender gap between the use of pharmaceutical stimulants and amphetamines as compared to other drugs, if you look at those in treatment, the gender gap for those in treatment for stimulant use or for disorders related to use of amphetamines is much bigger than the gender gap for all the other drugs that are listed. And you can see that infograph on the right-hand side of my screen. The information on treatment provision is not available for many countries. And this is based on reporting from 6 countries. So we see that treatment provision is a key pillar in national drug policies. And most of the countries that report do have provision of psychosocial treatment, pharmacological treatment, and so on in their national policies, as well as have provisions for those services. But one of the issues that we see is that the standard operating procedures, as well as measures of quality control, are literally lacking in most of the regions or countries from where such information is available. So finally, if you look at the coverage and the availability of most of the drug treatment intervention, especially for treatment of stimulant use disorders, especially when we look at psychosocial interventions, we see that there is a large gap in the availability and provision of most of the treatment interventions across the country. And as we see that this becomes a major issue when we look at the coverage and the availability of psychosocial treatment interventions for people with amphetamine or stimulant use disorders.
That was Cameron Niaz, epidemiologist at UNODC, speaking at the 2023 NIDA International Forum about stimulant use patterns as shown in UNODC's 2023 World Drug Report. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Stephen Shoptop, PhD, is a licensed psychologist and director of UCLA's Center for Behavioral and Addiction Medicine, also a professor in family medicine and psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences, and vice chair for research in family medicine at UCLA.
I'm going to spend the most time of this talk today talking about contingency management. It is an operant conditioning mechanism that supports this. The initial concepts for this application of operant conditioning was developed working with delinquent boys in housing settings. It was applied to methadone maintenance clinics. It's also been pioneered, the work by Steve Higgins' group, for treating cocaine use disorder, and has been augmented in many ways by Nancy Petrie using a fishbowl method rather than using vouchers to be able to deliver stimulants. Next slide. I'm sorry, incentives, not stimulants. We treat stimulants, we don't deliver them. In terms of the meta-analyses, you can see that across 4 studies, there's like a 40 to 60% increase in efficacy over a standard using contingency management, whether it's prize-based, whether it's voucher-based. This is so strong and is stronger than many medications in terms of the size of the impact of this treatment. And if contingency management were a medication, it would be standard of care. That's an important point. Before we move on to cognitive behavioral therapy, I do want to point out that contingency management is so flexible and so able to be adapted to international settings, even low middle income country settings. And one of my partners later in the talk will be talking about application within other settings of contingency management, or may reference that. So it is available to be used in low middle income countries. Cognitive behavioral therapy also is available for use around the world across different levels of countries. And this is teaches skills to instill abstinence. It focuses on skills to interrupt the trigger, thought, craving, and use cycle that is common to people who have stimulant use disorder. It teaches skills to prevent on how to return to abstinence, following use. And then there's plenty of work that shows that it's been taken up across the world. However, the signal is not that strong in terms of systematic reviews or randomized controlled trials. Even less powerful signal, but often used in LMIC settings, is motivational interviewing. The basic assumptions of motivational interviewing are that people change their thinking behavior along a series of stages. An interventionist is trained in how to deliver motivational interview techniques, and the goal is to elicit change talk. That's the talk that people have when they say, this is a problem for me, I'm thinking of doing something different. The interviewer actually then says, I hear you saying you want to change your behavior. And then the person actually explores that further, sets goals, and then moves forward. In this setting, conflict denial, the idea that somebody's not able to understand your advice, is interpreted as counterproductive and may actually be harmful to the process of change. And there's some evidence that this particular interaction works best with people who are young or maybe somewhat resistant to authority. I want to also point out that in the summary for behavioral therapies, that the primary driver here is that treatment works for who it works for. You saw that big dot of efficacy for treatment as usual. So the point is to have treatment out there. Some treatments will work for some, they will not work for others. Costs and the chronicity of stimulant use disorder mean that there's going to be, that's going to drive decisions about what's available out there. Contingency management is highly efficacious. The signal is consistent, and it's upon us to find ways to integrate it into our communities. Motivational interviewing and cognitive behavioral therapy are both strong, but the evidence is not and widely used, but the evidence is not as strong. And finally, I want to close with the idea that 12 steps, the idea about the 12 steps approach to changing addiction behavior, is an ubiquitous social fellowship. There's no evidence of efficacy but it does, because it's so broadly available, remain one of the most powerful psychosocial interventions for reducing stimulant use behavior in our world. Thanks.
That was Professor Stephen Shoptop, PhD, director of UCLA's Center for Behavioral and Addiction Medicine, speaking at the 2023 NIDA International Forum on the topic of established and emerging psychosocial interventions for treatment of stimulant use disorders. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Professor Nadine Ezard is director of Australia's National Centre for Clinical Research on Emerging Drugs, or NCRED, and also the clinical director of the Alcohol and Drug Service at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, Australia. Dr. Brendan Clifford is a senior research fellow with NCRED, and Dr. Krista Seyfried is clinical research lead at NCRED.
Before I start, I need to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this work was conducted and on which I am seated at the moment. I'm on Gadigal land in Australia. You people joining us here will be aware that Australia is made up of many Indigenous nations and First Nations. So I just want to pay my respects to elders past and present of the lands on which I am seated right now. Thank you. Next slide, please. The work we've been doing is informed by the last systematic review that we conducted. So Krista, who's presenting later, led this study looking at pharmacotherapies for methamphetamine use disorder. And I guess the key take-home messages are that there were no real effective treatments for methamphetamine use disorder, but all studies had low retention, which is something we need to be looking at, and that there were such a broad range of outcome measures that were studied, it was not possible to do any meta-analysis, and that's something that we collectively need to be looking at. The most suggestive positive findings were for so-called agonist therapies, so things like dexamphetamine or methylphenidate, as well as naltrexone and topiramate. There were less consistent benefits with bupropion and mirtazapine from that systematic review. However, since that review was done, next slide, please. There have been a couple of positive studies, both from the US. So the first was with a combination bupropion and naltrexone, and that led to decreased use amongst the people receiving the intervention rather than the placebo, with sort of low efficacy, but still an efficacy signal that I think is worth taking into account. And mirtazapine amongst cis men and trans women who have sex with men, where there was reduced use at weeks 24 and 36. That was a replication of an earlier study, so extending those results, even though the adherence to the medication was quite low. So those two are very promising findings. So when we look at the place of interventions in the kind of pyramid of the spectrum going from use all the way to dependence, depending on the criteria that you use, I've got DSM-4 here. DSM-5 is quite similar, of course, with the more severe substance use disorders at the top of the pyramid with lower frequency and the less severe substance use disorders down the bottom of the pyramid. Have a look at some of the emerging pharmacotherapies that are being studied around the world at the moment. So the first is bupropion and naltrexone, which I mentioned earlier. The next is mirtazapine. The next is growing interest in some of the psychedelic assisted psychotherapies. So we're working on in both the psilocybin and ketamine assisted psychotherapy space and piloting those therapies for the less severe substance use disorders, because people need to be abstinent for at least a few days before engaging in those therapies. And then the two promising directions that we're exploring, we're going to talk about now, is listexamfetamine for methamphetamine dependence, the LEMA trial. Brendan's going to present on that in a minute. And listexamfetamine for methamphetamine withdrawal, the OLEM trial, and Krista will present on that.
What we have here is just some of the rationales that we've gathered for our agonist therapy methods that we've been trying. Just with those rationales that it's usually a safer dose than what people are using, the route of administration being oral offers advantages, and it's fewer adverse effects compared to illicitly sourced stimulants and methamphetamine. And we've got models that we're already using in nicotine and opioid use disorders. They attenuate negative reinforcing effects and the tolerance to positive reinforcing effects. And because they're provided in the context of a healthcare organisation, provide a framework for other healthcare and psychosocial needs to be met in that kind of treatment framework. Some of the less amphetamine-like psychostimulants are not as effective as the ones like dexamphetamine, which has demonstrated feasibility and has been shown to reduce cravings and withdrawal symptoms and improve retention in some studies. But its change to methamphetamine use itself hasn't been shown to be significant. What we have started working with at St. Vincent's in trialing and our partner organizations is lisdexamfetamine, which is a prodrug of dexamphetamine and licensed for the use of ADHD and binge eating disorder to 70 to 140 milligrams. It's hydrolyzed in red blood cells to dexamphetamine, so it's a prodrug. It offers a slower onset and a lower peak concentration and longer duration of action than dexamphetamine. We have clients that we prescribe dexamphetamine to who sometimes report the euphoric effect of the immediate release can be something that triggers them into further use. Because it's hydrolyzed by the red blood cells, it also offers this advantage of, even if it is injected, it doesn't change the pharmacology or the pharmacokinetics of it. So there's no advantage to injecting over oral use. We piloted it in 2015 and 16. With the intention of systematic review, there's sometimes an underdosing. And so we tried a dose of up to 250 milligrams, so, twice that nearly of that was licensed for the use of other conditions. And that was shown to be tolerated at the 250 milligram dose level. of the 16 participants that we enrolled with us and partners at Hunter New England. And do note those two early withdrawals, but they were very much in the first week. And so we were able to, next slide please, progress to a randomized control trial that we did. You can see at the top there, it was a 15-week intervention that was based around a 12-week maintenance dose of 250 milligrams with an induction and reduction phase afterwards. We supervised administration once to two times a week. It was twice a week. It was impacted by COVID and we reduced the supervised administration because of needs to reduce foot traffic in clinic and protect staff and clients from healthcare settings. We also offered counselling for sessions of CBT, so that was it was in the context of a psychotherapy. The primary outcome that we chose, and I know Nadine's pointed to this earlier, and we'll come back to it again, was we looked at change of days of use in the previous 28 days at week 13 compared to baseline using timeline follow back. Now, are we still analysing that primary outcome? And hopefully soon we'll be finished. We are able to report that we did successfully enrol 155 participants, which was promising given the size of the population. And we only needed to discontinue two due to serious adverse effects. Otherwise, there were actually similar rates of adverse rate events between both groups, as you can see in that table over there. And promisingly, there was our observed retention at week 13 was a little bit higher in Elizabeth and Fetterman group, and not statistically significant, but you can see there that this, it was pretty acceptable. Again, retention is something that we need to look at in these studies.
So another study that we did looking particularly at the acute withdrawal phase, so the first 7 days after ceasing methamphetamine in people who were very dependent. I think for this study, it was over 14 days use in the last 28 days. And we looked at an open label single arm pilot study to assess the safety and feasibility of a tapering dose of lisdexamfetamine for that acute withdrawal period. So this was conducted in an inpatient drug and alcohol withdrawal unit. And the tapering dose will be on the next slide in just a moment, but the outcomes that we assessed over the 7 days and then at a 21-day follow-up visit included feasibility, safety, retention, treatment and satisfaction, withdrawal symptoms, and cravings on a visual analog scale. And those methods are published. The reference is there. Next slide, please. So this is the tapering dose where we started off enrolling participants through a centralized intake or through the emergency department. And after screening them for eligibility, they commenced the study drug on day one with a dose of 250 milligrams of lisdexamfetamine on awaking the first morning in the inpatient withdrawal unit. That decreased by 50 milligrams daily down to 50 milligrams on day five with an optional washout period for day six and seven. This was particularly important for some of our clients who had to have no stimulants in their system in order to go into a residential rehab setting, for example. The lisdexamfetamine was formulated in 50 milligram capsules, so that was five down to one capsule through the treatment period. And all participants received treatment as usual in that inpatient, so wraparound care, symptom management, and supportive care. So these results have been published by our PhD candidate, Liam Matchison, and the reference is there. It was in Drug and Alcohol Dependence late last year. We enrolled a sample of 10 adults. Unfortunately, these numbers do mirror some of the other problematic numbers around our lack of capacity to enroll or attract females into this study. So we were 90% male in this trial with a median age of 37 years. The study was open for 126 days, including COVID shutdowns. So we were able to feasibly recruit one participant per 12 days. And also considering that that was an inpatient bed for this study, 8 of the 10 participants completed the treatment to day five. 2 participants left early, not because of the study itself, but more because of the actual inpatient experience. So not wanting to be in the unit for various reasons. We didn't see any treatment-related serious adverse events. We did have 47 AEs, but none of them were serious. Whilst they were potentially causally related, they were graded as mild in severity. Acceptability for lisdexamfetamine by the TSQM questionnaire was rated at 100% at treatment completion. And these graphs are really small. They're bigger in the publication. But basically, we saw a waning of withdrawal severity and craving throughout the admission. And we didn't see any kind of spiking vasopressor effects having started or commenced at that higher dose. And then I'll hand back to Nadine to wrap us up and mindful. Yep.
So I guess this sums up a few things for us. But the first is the question about the relevance of relevance of findings from methamphetamine use disorder to cocaine use disorder. And we have seen the use of stimulant treatment for cocaine use disorder being effective, and whether there are sufficient similarities for us to be studying them together or separately. What is really important is that we do have some kind of harmonisation of outcome measures to enable some kind of meta-analysis. We do believe that clinically a reduction in days of use is relevant for people who are seeking treatment. It's certainly what the people who we speak to who are involved in the design of the studies informing us as helpful for them. So we do need a range of measures, but we need to also harmonise them so that we can meta-analyse them. The other thing is looking at harmonisation of measures of eligibility for the LEMA study, and also for the pilot we're going to do with bupropion naltrexone. We are fixing the baseline use at the more frequent end of use over the last 28 days. And I think that there is kind of emerging evidence that different kind of subgroups require different kind of treatment. So we do need to be have a common measure of which kind of subgroups we're studying. So again, so that we can meta-analyze and bring our efforts together. The context and structure of use is really important. And we do also need to have kind of measures to assess what is driving substance use disorders amongst different populations, and having measures of some of those social impacts and effects, such as social supports or other kind of impacts that might influence the harms that people experience from substance use, but also influence the capacity to participate in treatment or in trials. The other thing is what's the relationship between medication and psychotherapy. Certainly for our LEMA trial, where everyone was offered psychotherapy, that is the only evidence-based treatment we have available to us. So we do need to be looking at those things in combination. And it's really important to engage people in lived experience in the design and conduct of these studies, so that we are actually developing a treatment that people will find useful rather than one that we think a good idea. And what's really important here, I mean, I'm a doctor, Brendan and Kristen are nurses, we work in clinical practice. It's very, very important to engage people who are working clinically as well, so that we're building a clinical research workforce, so that we're not coming up with ideas that are very irrelevant to clinical practice.
That was Dr. Nadine Ezard, Dr. Brendan Clifford, and Dr. Krista Siffried, all with Australia's National Centre for Clinical Research on Emerging Drugs, speaking at the 2023 NIDA International Forum on the topic of emerging pharmacological interventions for the treatment of stimulant use disorders. And finally, a quick reminder that August 31st is International Overdose Awareness Day. Overdose Awareness Day is an annual event, the world's largest annual campaign to end overdose, to remember without stigma those who have died from overdose, and to acknowledge the grief of the family and friends left behind. Find information about International Overdose Awareness Day at the website overdoseday.com. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.